Shining down like water.
So, never seen the rain. He's back, they're back from Tula with stories and adventures to regale us here in Heck.
It's really good to be back here, Brett, and obviously just returned from Tula, El Lago, in the Montaña of Mexico. And that is the center of the Tolteca Nation, and it was the original spot picked by the first people who then influenced the Azteca and Mexica all the way down. So you had to have Toltec blood in your veins to be part of the royalty of the Aztecs, which were basically the last big tribe of Mexico. I think what's important is the pyramid there, which has the four Atlantean guardians on top. So it's got the four figures that have facial and hands and feet, and then those are the stalkers. And then behind them are four columns, which are basically rectangles, also rising up about 25 feet, that have some glyphs on them, but those are the dreamers. So you have four stalkers and four dreamers on the pyramid. And I think we covered in a previous radio show our connection with that pyramid from actually seeing an inorganic parasite come down on the pyramid when it was closed for COVID and take energy from the pyramid, and then our excursion at night to seal up the crack at the top, which is called the Tecali of the pyramid, later. So the adventures in Tula center around the Toltecs. And so all the stories we'll tell you now to add to this program are about the landscape of the Toltecs.
But more than the main pyramid, which is where the big ceremonies were held for all the people, there is a smaller pyramid. It's called the original pyramid, and that's Tula Chica, or Tula Chico.
Male or female.
And that pyramid was really for the closed-door priests who used to go there and make their intentions for the big picture or personal intention, etc.
So that place of the priest is not, it's in the same preserve, which covers many acres of natural land from the formal pyramid with the Atlanteans to Tula Chico. But Tula Chico is not visited by anyone other than sorcerers. And none of the turistas really know about it or go way out there to see the original one. But that was our favorite intending place, introduced to us by Don Arturo, our benefactor. Now this time, although we went there a few times, Twyla discovered an area on the side of the pyramid that was a wall of stone.
A purification well.
Yeah, like a well.
It's a square well right on the side of the pyramid where they would purify themselves before they go up to have
like
their
bath or
full
ritual.
Moon ceremonies around the disc.
What was important is we had been observing in the Anthropological Museum in Mexico City, our favorite artifact was a round disc about 18 inches in diameter, mosaic figures of warriors, and in the center is natural earth. Now, whether it was something glued on there, we don't know. But that artifact was so important to us, and it turns out that it was discovered in that purification pond.
They were preserving that disc in that pond, and there were layers. There's a diagram in that magazine that we discovered in one of our shaman friends over there had that magazine, and there were layers of different
elements. Stone, cloth, protecting the disc.
Protecting that disc, and we assume that they were doing their ceremonies around that disc.
Now, of course, a disc of Quetzalcoatl is the most important thing in the Toltec map. That's where the eight warriors, which are depicted in mosaic,
I was going to ask
fly.
If that was connected.
Exactly. This is a disc of Quetzalcoatl that was preserved here and discovered probably in the 1960s. It's a fairly new artifact. And that it was at this pyramid we were working on which holds great significance to all of the priests of Tolteca. So I go to the top of it, and I'm seeing that the outline of it is the framing of a jaguar. And no one told me this before, but I can see where the eyes and the ears, the mouth, all the, I can also see a strange impression in the top, which I proceed to lay in. And I have outstretched arms and legs. Twyla's meanwhile down at the purification trough. And here comes Quetzalcoatl. And I'm listening in the sky, and I'm also dreaming. And all of a sudden, I get the information that this was the exact place where Tepiltzin Quetzalcoatl, the last Quetzalcoatl, laid to do the ceremony that he would be leaving Tula, because he leaves to one day return, and that he did this ceremony right there at Tula Chico before he left, so that he left his energy impression at the top of the pyramid, waiting for another Nawal to come back and lay in that exact configuration so that he could actually return in the next body of a future Nawal, which was me. So now I was Quetzalcoatl.
Right.
It was complete. He was back. Immediately when I stood up, Twyla said, "You have to come down." And what happened?
Well, the guards came and wanted us out of there. It was a very strange thing because we both knew that this is a very special place to make intention. And I had made the intention that, how did it go? I wanted us to rise with our art so that we can have more influence with our arts, Toltec influence with our arts. But I also said something in my intention about and may the prison makers be pushed out or something like that. I can't remember exactly how I intended it. And here they are, they showed up. And I'm going, oh my God, I indulged too much. But then what happened?
Then the prison guards waited till I finished my ceremony. They actually waited for me to come down and complete that. So they understood who we were, and they understand the sacredness of what we were doing there. But somebody had told them
to get you out of there.
Yeah.
Exactly. So what they did is we started walking the long Camino, the long path.
And they escorted us in the back.
Way in the back. One was on like a motorbike and the other was walking. But whenever we'd stop, they were very respectful. I could go up to them and I would say, "Well, what's it?" And he'd go, "Oh, there's an águila, there's an eagle up in the sky." And he would move into our assemblage point. And I realized that Quetzalcoatl, who I was now, was actually free at last from all of this, all of the pyramid grounds. He had left his impression long ago. Now to be escorted out with the new Ardias to actually have this procession down the Camino. So Twyla and I began dancing. We began doing stuff in front of the guards, and they respectably watched everything as if this was part of the program.
It's awesome.
Now, what happened later, after we left, and we realized, oh, you know, we're free now, is that there was a big fire at the base of the formal pyramid. That's where the Atlanteans are. And Twyla had intended that everything be purified on the grounds now, that we were free at last. And so this fire was the first one up there, and the current administration, who was responsible for the guards...
And those guards were all fired.
They were all fired.
It was a strange thing how my intention carried eventually
out. And it got rid of...
They got rid of everyone.
Because we felt like the pyramids were in prison. Like, we were saying, well, can't we just walk the grounds? We understand this is a historical marker. Maybe we can't just go up on the pyramid, but can we just walk the grounds? And we couldn't even do that.
So we've heard from our allies in Tula that the current administration had tried to do a sacred ceremony, like a temescal, which is a kind of the Lakota version. It's called a sweat lodge. Mm-hmm. They create these domes where people go inside in with heated rocks and meditate. So the temescal is a very, very sacred thing to the Toltecs in that whole area. they did it wrong, and they did it in the pyramid grounds where they weren't supposed to, an area, and those hot rocks or whatever caused that sacred ceremony, which they had done wrong and improperly, caused the fire of purification. So the administration, all those guards, everybody was fired, and the new ones who were coming in were definitely going to now open up the grounds once again and return to the sacred intention of the entire thing.
But it was a big deal that we went dreaming there because we knew about the place from Don Arturo, but we made discoveries preceding the finding of the disc. We made a discovery that that was closed door pyramid as opposed to the big pyramid that was for the open door ceremonies. And it indeed was a very, very powerful place. We made a few intentions that almost instantly, occurred.
Tell the intention, because when her father had died and she was in Tula, she had intended
a certain
place.
Wow, that's pretty personal. I mean, my father died when I was in Mexico, in Tula. And I did a ceremony for him, and I found a place to put some gifts for him, and I returned to that place. And what I found in that place was a hatched egg.
Wow.
I went back there, and I'm seeing right where I put the little things that I put, I found a hatched egg. And I realized that he, just now, as I was there, came for another round in Mexico, where I was.
So we began to look for babies that would have been him. And that's another part of the
That was pretty trippy, but it was also enforced by my dreams. I had some dreams that already told me that in some way, but this was the final
step. Confirmation.
Oh, yes, that validated all of my dreams. And I even, in my dreams, saw where his new family is. So a very, very, very powerful magic in Mexico, the land of dreams.
Well, it's not so here. Just the air is full of flyers, for lack of a better term, maybe.
What there is, there's not a temple in the center like there is in Tula. Everything revolves around this pyramidal center. So everyone in the town and throughout Mexico has free days on the weekend where anybody from Mexico can go to these sacred sites. And that umbrella, I think, keeps it as a safe space for dreaming. Our other important, there's a lot of magic connected with the pyramid. As soon as that door was open and Quetzalcoatl was there, people started coming up to us, and beggars on the street, or people who were selling small tokens, said, you've returned to the place of our teacher. And then they would mention Carlos Castaneda to us. And then the tour buses that were going by only on the weekend, very few people there, Carlos Castaneda stayed in that hotel. All of a sudden, muralists showed up, young muralists, who began to do a large dome painting of the return of Quetzalcoatl with his whole lifespan.
In the main El Centro Dome.
Dome.
Yeah, they connected with us, and they will be arriving.
Yeah, they're coming here to
for a job.
For a job. Really, so all these people started opening up and telling us this is Don Juan's bench. These are the things that are connected with Tolteca deeply. And
so we went and sat on Don Juan's bench, and I just happened to sit there and close my eyes, and I said, Don Juan, you must be really far from here. There is no way that I can reach you, even though I'm sitting on your bench. And all of a sudden, I was like in deep silence, complete silence. And he's like looking at me and he goes, my God, you really stopped the world. And he's talking and I'm like, I'm still in like this position. And what I felt at that moment is that Don Juan's spirit was embodying exactly in the same position that I was sitting. Like he was sitting exactly, a replica, like a replica of me was inside of me, and it was him. And I've never been able to be as silent as I was at that moment, not before and not after. Okay, it was really like
a, I thought she was dead, that was it.
I know, he couldn't believe it, and I couldn't believe it. It was a total, I'm saying, Don Juan was there, and I'm saying, you know, we better let other people know where the bench is so people can go and visit with Don Juan.
It's like a portal. So then she says, why don't you try it the next night? So I go to the bench, and I'm there meditating, and he's sitting opposite me on the other bench. And he has a dome over him, like a triangular energy field. And I said, what are you seeing? And he goes, I'm seeing myself.
Yeah.
So we're the mirror for each other. And so that became another focal point that, you know, to bring people to.
But to find the real Don Juan bench.
Yeah.
That's... I mean, we met an elder that used to be a little boy when Don Juan lived. And his father did some of the editing for the Carlos books.
Wow.
So he knew exactly. That's a real source. He knew exactly where the bench was. And not only that, it all made so much sense. Behind the bench, there is this tree. It's kind of like a protector, guardian tree, and like a it has a dome over it. It's like, it was just a perfect bench to sit on.
It also captures the setting sun and the star of Venus, which represents Quetzalcoatl. So it has the whole view of night and day there.
And it will be our next
album
of
All Orange
Multimedia, Don Juan's Bench.
Bench.
It was a really great experience. Yeah. You know, as big as our experience in the Tula Pyramid. In the Tula Chico Pyramid, I requested to see Quetzalcoatl again, because last time when we were there 3 years ago with Don Arturo, as soon as I sat down, I looked up and I've all of a sudden seen this white snake, exactly how they draw it. Exactly how they draw it, like with the mouth open, and it's like traveling like this right in front of me. It's very, very milky, almost like a cloud. So I asked to see it again, and it came to me, but in a different way this time, with my eyes closed. And all of a sudden there's this big eye right across from my eye, but very, very close, looking at me. And all of a sudden, I see that the eye is turning to be his eye. So I'm like confirming that Quetzalcoatl is now him.
Right.
Because I see the eye and then I see his face. Him.
So the next step for me as Quetzalcoatl is to go to the original Don Juan Matus and Carlos Castaneda power spot, which is just outside of Tula. It's in a big canyon. You have to hike down. And that has what are called Los Organos, or the big columns of stone that are in the middle of this valley. And they were placed there by the Anunnaki. The Anunnaki are prior to the Toltecs. So we're talking about, according to Don Arturo people, we're talking over 15,000 years old. These were the first sculptures ever placed on the earth older than the cave art that you see in France or in the world. So this sculpture is the first model for what's called a Chacmol. So it's kind of like a very large tail of a serpent, and then it comes down where you can lay, and there's an offering bowl that's been carved in it, and then the serpent's head. And this was the original template for all the Chacmol sculptures that came later that are the entrance to most of the pyramids where people leave their offerings.
So we saw that there, the first Chacmol, the first pyramid, right?
Yep. Yeah,
and what we discovered is evidence that these things were built.
Made by hand.
Built by men. Hand. Where at first look, it looks like just rocks.
But it's not.
But They're not.
It's a construction.
Yeah,
construction.
Absolutely. It's
all
a
these
sculpture.
Things. So there's
they're
10 or 12 of these big columns around the Shock Mall
and then
in the center.
There's so when you just descend down into the valley, you've got the first group, and there's a double of that group. And the double is where the, it's like the Tonal and the Nawal. And where the double is,
separated
is
by a small river.
Where the first Chak Mall and the first pyramid is. And that's where we believe is a portal to the Dome of the Nawals.
And, of course, then we began to realize that we could open up the second attention really easily there. And we had been having experiences like getting lost. You might be walking side by side by a person, and you turn to continue talking to them, and they'd be gone. And you can't find them.
Parallel lines.
Parallel tubes.
Parallel lines that actually you kind of get swallowed. All of a sudden, somebody's lost, and you won't find them until the end of the day. Or it really is a very, very special place. And you see many, many dreaming personal dreaming spots where they were manicured by past sorcerers with rocks
like
and
sculpted out
ways.
Bowls. You can
so you them. See that somebody created it for their body to lay down and dream. And then as you walk into the field of rocks and stones, you start to feel like you're getting elevated, like you're lighter and lighter and lighter. Very, very special place.
So one of the things I'll throw in, I had to bring my son, who had just returned from Peru, down to Los Organos. It was like one of my big things I had to complete to give him this experience. He's a stone worker. So we go down there, and in the process of the day of working, he comes up to me and he goes, "Dad, I want to show you something about one of these columns." And in there is an embedded, about 6 feet up, a piece of wood. A validation that these things were constructed by, in this case, Anunnaki, that they had to use these to build these things. So we're there, and we're going to open up the second attention, one of our journeys, and Twain and I are sitting side by side, and we're looking at this big array of Nepali cactus. They're kind of like bowl-shaped cactus leaves, forming like almost a tree in front of us. All of a sudden, we notice that there is a blossom opening on just one. Only one blossom is opening, very slowly, pink blossom. We're watching this thing, and then this bee comes in. It's an extremely large entity
golden,
coming in.
Golden.
And we have always been asking various questions. This was a day where we wanted to understand the depth of seeing. The final card necessary in our map to become a seer. Coming out of the flower is a huge plume of energetic field, which is why the bee entity can see it from a great distance without even seeing the flower. They see the energy plume and are attracted then to the flower for their nectar or whatever they're going to do. So that was when the whole second attention opened up. One of the most important things was, as Quetzalcoatl, I have to hang out with the gods now. In the sky are the four gods, right there in front of me. Tezcatlipoca, Huitzilopochtli, Mitlantecuhtli, and obviously the personification, as you're saying, of Quetzalcoatl, because I am Tepiltzin Quetzalcoatl, which is a name for the lineage of artists, but the dragon-like entity of Quetzalcoatl is the god figure. And they're all four sitting there, and they're telling me very clearly that they're going to show me that this whole dome is a dome that they created. The whole world they created. And they're going to show me that you can pierce through that sky dome. So here comes an eagle. And the eagle flies into the space and goes between the manifestation of these gods, right through a slit, and is gone, going into the other side of the dome. And that my position in order to be a seer means that I've done two very, very important things. That is, you remove the flyer, which is attached to the back of your head, that inorganic entity which we filmed on the Tula Pyramid. The second thing you have to do to become a seer is to close your front gap, which is the gap that death enters, the rolling force of death. So you remove the flyer from the back of your head, and you close your gap. After you've done those two things, then you are ready to be initiated into the world of seeing. You also have an opportunity to either, in this position, stay here on Earth by assuming, as Tepilsin Quetzalcoatl did to me, new Nawal bodies for as long as you want, that exchange, or you can leave and become part of the sun. Those are your two options. If you stay here, you will eventually become an Anunnaki, which is the name for the people who guard the domes of the Nawal, and you will put on the suit of immortality. The Anunnaki realized that they wouldn't die. But there was a battle between the dark and the light, and some of them did die. So they became invisible. They became the caretakers and the seeders of worlds into awareness, but they couldn't expose themselves very much, because once they found out that they were vulnerable to dark entities that could prevent them from living forever, they became the invisible protectors and the invisible bestowers of awareness to planet. So those are your choices.
And they are represented with those columns, those organal columns, sculptures that they built, because they are there. I mean, we feel their presence. Mm-hmm. There is a specific spot in between all those columns, a seating spot, where I discovered I could go sit and ask my biggest questions to my biggest issues, but you better be ready to receive the real truth, because most people are not ready to really receive the truth.
So they
are there. They are there, and they give advice, and they will actually help you actuate that advice, but you better be ready for that. So don't sit in that seat unless you're ready. The presence of sorcerer spirits in the whole valley is undeniable for seers, and it's a very special place. Yeah, it's a very protected space, because it's a bowl. I've noticed since then many bowls in Ankamba. Mm-hmm. We have a bowl. As we were driving by on the freeway towards GRC, mm-hmm. I noticed that all the mountains, they form circles.
Yep.
You drive, there's a circle of mountain, you pass that, there's another circle of mountain. So there's all these bowls. Mm-hmm. Most bowls are huge. They're really, really big. They're almost too much to notice.
Right.
But in Los Organos, the bowl is very, very intimate. And so the spirit love it there. There has been a lot of sorcerers who were dreaming there. We're convinced that Don Juan's core of warriors was dreaming there. And that's what we're noticing, their spirits.
So we return, and one day Don Arturo goes, "Oh, you guys were at Los Organos." And I said, "Well, how'd you know?" He said, "Well, I went there with another party of warriors, and there were blue lines of energy everywhere. And I knew you guys had just been working there." Is he phoning?
It was Greg.
Is he phoning?
Yeah, did you want
to... Yeah, let's talk to him.
Yeah, we can stop a minute.
Yeah.
I mean, he could be part of the... That's why I was...
Yeah. Oh, no, I'll just leave it on then.
Yeah,
worst case scenario, I can edit it out.
Oh, my son.
Hello?
My son is here. I was just talking...
Are you driving right now?
No, I'm actually here. You're on the radio here in Heck with Brett.
Oh,
yeah,
we're in TUC.
Live broadcast with you here. Because I was just talking about you.
USC, great. All right.
Yeah, and I was just telling him about how you found that little piece of wood in one of the organos columns, right, verifying that they were made by hand. They weren't natural structures.
I mean, I say 90% sure. I don't want to. I mean, yeah. There are. I'm not a master geologist, so it might be possible. You know, I'm not an expert. That's not my field, but it did seem to suggest that potentially those were man-made.
Yeah. Well, we're going. I always go with you, my son, as the next level of seeing.
But we saw the base of them.
Yeah, we saw the base being different as we investigated further.
Built from
different foundational rocks. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, what was your experience in Los Organos when you were there?
I mean, it was a journey from. Let's see, we had the cows. I was a little nervous. I didn't know. I'm not used to wild cows.
You mean the bulls?
The bulls.
Wild bulls.
Yeah, wild bulls. Horses. That's what they call them. No, wild cows. Yeah, they came up so close just to check things out. Then we had the spider webs.
Yeah, there was spider webs.
Yeah, the spider webs sort of started it off in their, interplay with the light, and they're catching, I mean, the spider webs were placed very strategically. They had mastered it. They had a lot of food in the web. And, I mean, then we came to the rock columns, and I haven't seen any site form like that, so I don't know how it was built, but, it was very impressive. And then you take a step back and you look at the entire layout of why that site would be chosen. And I just come back from Peru, and all the major sites of Peru had real selection of where they built their most important sites in that sort of U-shaped like ravine, I'd say.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Bowl again.
That bowl, yeah.
Nice.
Hello?
Yeah, we're still there. So then you proceeded to help your dad was very weak. He had put out a lot of energy. He was using his Boston, his walking wand. And what did you do?
And what?
What did you do to help your elder father out?
Oh, I mean, that was, this is the hell of, you know, future generations too, we built a stepping stone path through the water. They're walking on the water to cross to the other side.
Super.
But moving the big stones. You said it's still there. I tried my best to use of comfort for walking, but also permanence. So, yeah, hopefully they didn't wash away. We had to move quick. Because didn't want to keep you waiting too long, but yeah, me and Tecolote found the good stones, and
nice.
We were inspired from our recent trip to the Sacred Valley of Peru. So yeah, we built a couple little pathways.
Now, speaking of the wild bulls that are there, this guy was bringing down the bulls, and they were on the same path as we were exiting one day. And he stopped and started talking to Twyla, but he somehow wanted to take her iPhone. And I was sitting on the side, but Twyla did an amazing karate move.
Wasn't me, it was my double.
She was in her double, so she like flipped him down the mountainside.
It's going too fast. First of all, how he was guiding the wild bulls.
It was his herd, and they were coming down, I guess, to drink from the water. They were coming from the top of the mesa.
Did he have dogs, or he just...
Yeah, he had dogs.
Yeah, he had dogs and a lot of the bulls. So somehow he wanted to, we believe, steal Twyla's iPhone. And Twyla will not... I mean, that's like a mother bear. And, you know, she like flipped him down the mountain, and the guy ran for cover, and all the herd went with him.
Well, Twyla is braver than me because I was pretty nervous just seeing the Wild Bulls alone, not even with the mastermind behind the whole pack.
Well, no, I feel safe now with her going into any sort of battlefield.
Yeah.
So,
the warrior.
That's good. Yeah.
Well, I think I actually think
telling the story because I got my phone stolen, and I could learn from you, I guess.
Oh my God! I'll tell you another story one day that's related to iPhone, but not to Los Organos. So.
Well, so all right, we're going to take a break because I'll talk to you off radio here.
And indeed. We now jump a few days to the second part of this amazing Here in Heck, Don't You Go Anywhere.
Hello, this is Here in Heck. This is...
Well, this you can is, still like use it as a symbol, like the talking pillow in Breaking Bad.
This is Here in Heck, episode 100. And we have today a special guest. Who is this?
Bo Elizabeth Roberts.
She happens to be the daughter of...
Well,
she happens to be the daughter of the shaman artist, Q.
The man of many names. And yes, we are back here in Heck. And it's a real treat. We're getting to meet the daughter of Q, Bo. And we're all just very curious what... it was like, and what it's like, having a Quetzalcoatl as a father.
That's a great question. You know, I'm still trying to figure that out. I think about it all the time. What does it mean that I am my dad's daughter? And how do I put that into play in my own life? It's it brings up a lot of questions for me. Mostly it's amazing. I mean, I have the best dad in the universe, so I feel pretty grateful about that. And I have a lot of stories I could tell.
Oh, well, we want to hear some.
We definitely want to hear some.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I have a little 2-year-old son now, and so we've had 2 birthday parties for him so far. And when I know his birthday is coming up, it's mostly a big deal for the parents at this point, but I get pretty excited to celebrate, and I think, what are we going to do? And it's made me reflect on what happened in my own birthday parties when I was a kid. And every year, my dad would put on a pretty outstanding magic show for all my friends. What was your name?
Manu. Manu, which turns out to be one of the original names in the Sumerian text of the Anunnaki. I picked it simply, really? Phonetically. It was kind of interesting, you know, the magician Manu, because I had once been the pink turban, and I never really liked that name. It came about because I borrowed a pink scarf from my mother. But anyway, Manu the magician would entertain you.
Yeah, really entertaining. But even that answer right there, it's like there's so much that comes out that I have no idea or understand even what is going on. And so it's constantly this reflection for me of, wow, you know so much. I can never retain all that information. I'm never going to remember, except for thank goodness for this recording, that was where the name Manu came from. But I do have my experiences, I guess.
Yeah. When was the first time you realized that, you know, you had other friends and they had parents and a dad? When did you realize that you were in a unique situation?
I used to have other adults tell me all the time as a kid how special my dad was, and I thought that was really annoying at the time. It really drove me crazy. Like, how do you think that I don't know that my parent or my dad is special? Like, that you think that you need to tell me? I thought that was, like, the most infuriating thing as a kid. I mean, I think every little kid thinks their parent is special. When did I realize that you were particularly important and special? I think I always knew.
I'm reflecting on there were moments when we were in nature when you would do something that would move my assemblage point, so I would do something to enhance you remembering it, like when I saw you moving the flower from the dirt, the little flower, to the air. And I realized you were dipping it in ink in the air to do your drawing on the sand. Oh. And so I talked about that, I wrote about that in your baby book, because we were bonding, and I think those seeing moments were the things that were beyond normal parenting.
Yes, yeah. I always felt really supported in everything creative. And I guess when I would go over to other friends' houses, I would see what their parents were like, and it was a little disappointing. It wasn't quite
just
the same.
A stockbroker or something.
Yeah, or what does your parent do? Oh, they're like a doctor. What does that mean? Or, I don't yeah.
Okay, what do they do?
Yeah. And I remember describing what you did to my friend's parents. Like, oh, what did your parents do? Oh, my dad's an artist. And they were always very curious, like, what does that mean? And I remember, or I would tell them that you made signs. You had your sign business at the time. And I remember describing it and knowing that I had kind of confused the other parents. Like, they didn't quite follow or wanted more information. Then, I don't know, that's just what he does. But.
Making signs. Making yeah. signs. But, you know, really, when we are recapitulating her background, you know, working together, it's kind of like the trauma stands out a lot. You know, we were thinking, what's the fruit that that we remember? And it was when she was vomiting up all these blueberries because she had fallen off her chair and hit her head. So I remember the blueberries.
When I was a little baby.
Right. Yeah. Or she twisted her leg with these really expensive blue jeans. You remember
that's
that?
Right. I dislocated my knee. And the paramedics had to cut my jeans in order to fix my knee. And I was mostly upset about the jeans.
It's horrible.
The knee was
oh, that must have hurt. How'd you manage that?
It was such a silly thing. I wasn't even doing anything. I've dislocated it again since. And every time it's happened, which is only 3 times, I think, my whole life, it's been something really minor, like bending the wrong way. Yeah, something really bizarre.
You know, coming back to New Mexico, because she hadn't seen the place where we're recording this Space Castle before, and I used to take them on road trips to New Mexico to sacred sites like Chaco Canyon. And we were remembering a moment when I had the 3 kids there. She was maybe, what age were you?
I don't know. If there were 3 of us, at least 7?
Yeah, but you reminisce you had your first period.
Oh, in Chaco Canyon?
Yeah, yeah. And I had to go up on the mesa because I had placed ceremoniously these 3 special rocks in a bowled-out shape that I had to go up there and remember because I was going through a divorce, so I had placed them in a protected area to keep my kids safe during all this transition. And so I hurried and I had to climb up the mesa and I left Beau there with the 2 younger brothers. What happened when I came back?
So my brothers and I realized that we'd been abandoned in the desert with no food or water or shade. So I don't remember exactly, but the reason you mentioned my period, I had terrible cramps, which at that point in time was like really debilitating to me. I was like, my stomach hurts so badly. I think I was underneath the picnic table because that was the only shade.
Yep.
And the brothers, I think they found a rattlesnake. The story kind of escalated.
With the rattlesnake. So I tried to come back and explain. I had to do the spirit journey. And Bo, you know, she's like her Taurus thing. She's really, Dad, there's no way out of this one.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And now, as a parent, I can understand what happened, but kids, you can't explain your logic to the kids.
Yeah, it's hard.
You're just there to serve them, I think, for a long time.
Yeah, what's it like being a parent now, just to throw things completely down another track for a moment?
Well, I feel really inspired to make sure I always support his wild creative side, even though I'm raising him in suburbia, and just like us, though, I guess we have that. But it's great. I love it. Never loved anything more. It's wonderful. Yeah, he's so sweet.
But you're using certain techniques that you learned when we worked together.
Yeah.
And what are those things? Like with rocks, you're doing things that you told me.
The art of seeing. Well, you pay attention to, like, what his favorite little things are, and he loves to throw rocks into water, so you just kind of enhance it for him and make sure he has opportunities to do those things all the time and figure out what it means, and I kind of just follow his lead. I like to follow his lead a lot. He's already perfect.
So he was placing rocks, or you were doing something, and he had to find which rock you had placed or something, right?
I don't
or
remember.
Something you were doing there in Marin?
Oh, probably.
Did you? But doing things with rocks is definitely a
big
connection.
Oh, yeah, he likes rocks. Yeah, rocks all the time.
So we went through a traumatic time in that when I was getting divorced, I had to be a single dad to the three of them. And I was doing, a kind of cross-country thing. I was down in Southern California and then have to drive back to Northern California to take care of them. And as I look back on that transition with them, was there anything that stands out? I was using my younger son to make a movie at the time, so he was always with me a lot of the time. But it was anything you can remember about that which would normally be a difficult thing, I think we made it into something less traumatic.
Yeah, I mean, it was always great. You were always really present with us when we were there. But it is hard, I think, it's really hard to watch your parents change a lot. I think there's like something, I think at least I expected your parents to be kind of consistent. And my parents changed, both of them, in different, really different ways completely. And it was hard to see, it's hard to see your parent also with a new partner. That was always the hardest part for me. So I had a hard time with the partners, and just seeing you care about somebody else, that was always pretty irritating. Pretty self-involved, turns out.
What's funny is there was a woman living upstairs in the house where they were raised, and I said, well, maybe that's a good mate, because I really don't know how to date women at the time. So I said, well, she already knows my kids. And she's really good at playing with
them. There
was
a lot of drama there, though. There
was a lot of drama.
My mom's best friend.
Yeah, that was her mother's best friend living upstairs. So I said, perfect. I'll use her for my next girlfriend. Which was kind of interesting because she was teaching you sewing and she was starting to go down the magical path and she was already a musician. But you're saying good choice or bad choice? What do you think from your perspective?
No, I was not a fan of that. Your good choice is sitting right here to my left.
Who's that?
Once Tyler came into the picture, everything got golden. That was when everything finally made sense. I always loved Twyla from the beginning. It's like, she's the only one that's not insane.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
It's true.
Wait, you're saying all the other, my other choices, they had some mental defect or something?
They seem a little crazy to me.
Well, I didn't know what to do. It's a random, you know, you kind of like bump into, I don't go to bars or anything, right? So why is Twyla the perfect one?
Because she's an excellent stalker and she's in touch with spirit and can dream. Perfect combination.
What do you mean by stalker?
She knows how to do all the in the world stuff. And mm-hmm. Well, and you take good care of us. You're such a good mom. She does everything.
And she leads, so it's balanced. She leads in the world and out of the world.
Exactly.
Both.
Perfect.
Yeah. Wow, I didn't know that you had such great opinion of me.
Of course I do.
Or experience, let's say. Experience.
From the beginning.
Oh, that's great.
That's neat. Not Twyla's great.
She accomplishes everything from a spirit direction. So she once found, I did these cards with the woman we were talking about, my bad choice, one of my bad choices. And what are these cards here? I go, I don't know, I did those drawings. So she brings them out, and for the last 15 years, would you say?
We're all using those cards.
Oh, yeah.
Bo has a set.
I have a set. That's how I make my major life decisions.
With her husband, did the cards.
Yep.
And I kept going, I don't know about this guy, really. Dad, what do the cards say?
Yeah, every time.
They were right.
The cards are always right. So
now we have the ascendant master grandson.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was Twyla who said, you know, although we're out of the world with the cards, it's a bridge, and we're going to use it for all of our worldly decisions.
Nice. That was you?
Yeah.
Well, the cards basically are reflecting the double. In other words, they're reflecting your intuition. When you pick the cards, your double actually participates and picks the card for you. And that's your intuition.
Mm.
So it's out of your mind.
Huh. Beautiful. Yep. And that's been true every time I've ever used them.
So you've been to... this is the only one of his facilities that I've had the pleasure of being at. But how is this one different than the ones you've
been
to? Oh, man.
They're all incredible museums. And this is still... These are all the questions that come up for me of how do I even understand the depth of what is my father? I mean, it's mind-blowing. I haven't been to this one until this trip. Mm-hmm. I came here with them when they bought this property... like 15 years ago before it was all built out. And so I had no idea I had an idea what I was in for, but this exceeds all high expectations. But the other ones are outstanding too. You should definitely...
Oh, that's... It's
on
in
the list.
The plans.
Nice, in the plans. Akumba is... Well, compared to here, interestingly, it's like the most connected to nature because you're already in the land, in the space. And it's also exceptional. And there's a few different spaces in that one. They're all so beautiful. And the art is everywhere. I mean, they're all museums. And you have the pyramid in Akumba, which is pretty special. But they all connect, too. Like, even the one in Ukiah, too, which is also a beautiful museum, has the same assemblage point. It's all, like, it's very connected. And then you can find... The type of experience that you have here in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, is available to you in Ukiah and in Akumba.
It's like a feel thing. It feels...
Yeah. There's no question that they're all connected.
Yeah, this... I am kind of kept out of here, 10 months a year, so when they come back, I come in the door, it's like air again or something.
Yeah, opening that door, it's like whoosh.
Well, when Shru opened the door of the space castle and walked in, this little guy...
That's my son.
2 years old. Yeah. He says, "This is magic."
Yeah.
I heard him say that.
Yeah.
And that's what's connecting.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. He's starting to look more closely at it, too. I think at first it's like you're taking it all in, but you don't get the details. And before you came over today, he was starting to point out what's spooky.
Uh-huh.
He's starting to see, spooky rattlesnake, spooky figure. He's starting to But he's not really scared. He loves it.
Well, we had to cover certain of the images with post-it stickers when there was a 2-year-old living here.
Oh, really?
She, the little girl Mystic, would go, "That's a spooky." So put a little sticker.
Oh, she would too?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. If some of the,
I wonder if it's the
if
same.
It was a smile and a frown at the same
mm-hmm.
time, there's a few of those things that are dualistic.
That's a spooky.
She couldn't figure out, but
okay. I didn't know that. I've seen the symbol, but I didn't know it actually was a more like some esoteric joke or something.
Yeah.
A meme or something.
Right.
Everything's a meme.
Everything's a meme. I don't know.
I think some of the things that come back when we were, I use the term working together, in nature or in the city, Bo would begin to do a magical leadership. And I always liked those moments. For example, she would come up with the idea, "Today, when we're all together, we're not going to spend any money. But we're still going to do things that normally take money to do." You remember that?
Yeah. I don't know.
Talk about that.
I don't remember coming up with that. It's funny that you say I'm a leader because I feel like I can be in some settings, but when I'm with my dad, I go into like total follow mode. I just don't make any decisions and just go into his world. But yeah, that we did. We had this really fun, one particular day, even though I think it happened a few times, where somehow we made that rule that we weren't going to spend money. And so we would figure out the things that you could do for free, like going into an ice cream shop and just having this, like how they give you tastes of ice cream. So
as many tastes as possible.
Oh,
we're not talking about one taste.
But not buy an ice cream.
So it would add up to a whole
and
Sunday.
Yeah.
Or See's Candy gives away.
Right, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's like certain places that will give you a free sample. At that time, when I think when Whole Foods first opened, which is around this time, they had a lot of samples. So I think we went like to Whole Foods. Right. Did we go into places that were free? Was this all about food?
Yeah.
It's probably all about food.
Well, I think we found museums or something.
Okay.
But I remember the ice cream thing particularly.
Yeah.
Because I said, wow, that you can actually continue to ask them to taste that flavor.
Yeah, can I have another
I thought about that. I thought it was a really magical
a
way that you know, a child will lead you, their seeing is based on places like ice cream parlors that are so impactful. So Luke, her younger brother, just sent me pictures of places that we took him to, but abstract pictures, and asked me on the iPhone, "Where am I, Dad?" And he's bringing his daughter there. So there would be like Double Rainbow, which is another ice cream place.
Oh, nice.
He would just take a picture of the floor or the stool.
Oh, okay. Like just
right, and then because that had an impact on him, and now he was introducing his daughter to this game of, you know, having either finding places that are magical or so. He's continuing the guidance.
I really liked in the voice of seeing the story about the dump. How you took them to the dump and you found the picture of the bear.
Oh,
do you
okay.
remember that? Or
well,
I mean, does Bo
that's a collection
it?
Of things. Well, what we would do is try to find out. I did this with Graham just recently. He wanted to go to a homeless encampment and interact with the people there. And it's in San Francisco in Emeryville.
Recently?
Yeah, well, you know, 10 years ago or something
okay.
like that. So he wanted to go to where I have my magic theater, Wonder Wish, and
okay.
just look at the sign. Everything that I'd done, if there was any remnant or any artifact left.
Mm-hmm.
So I told him that when I took down my theater, I took it to the dump in this location. So he wanted to go to that dump location and see if any of the recycled parts of Wonder Wish were being used by the homeless people.
Wow.
Because I had painted these things bright colors and
yeah.
they would stand out from everything else. So we were in the middle of the dump and, of course, immediately activating this particular guy under the Quetzalcoatl banner of Tolteca and spying things through two little tubes. And we had done a movie, too. So that whole interaction in the dump was kind of for me, remembering when, you know, one of my children wants to lead me, they are also honoring how I led them. In other words, Wonder Wish was still in his mind. Let's continue the process. And I think that sort of thing creates a lineage of passing down the magic. You know, will True show up at the Emeryville dump looking for the little tubes that we look through? Maybe he sees a video of it. You know, there's a continual creative performance piece.
That's neat.
But as Bo read The Voice of Seeing, I was curious to hear from you if it reminded you of certain moments in your childhood or if you
yeah.
want to share.
Well, the ending really stood out.
Yeah, the ending. Well, because it was, when I read it, it was before I had a child. And I was nervous and excited and all the things about, oh, am I going to get to be a parent? Am I going to figure this whole thing out? And so there's like a premonition at the end of me with my children at the end. So it was very hopeful.
And but then what's the magic? Who are you with on the beach?
My little son.
It was a boy.
Yeah.
So that made it very magical.
Yeah.
You know? Like, Dad, how did you know? Well, you know, I didn't really know. But there's only two choices there for that end.
You got lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there any specific creative realm that you pursue, your visual arts or painting or writing or?
I mean, the thing I've been doing the most in the last 10 years or so is dance, which
movement.
Is not really
it is,
about you, but it's my own. Yeah, I really love it.
If that's where, you know, if that's where you're expressing yourself, that's.
Yeah.
Well, recently you're also telling stories.
Oh yeah, I started telling stories
making
to my son. That's been
a continuing
really fun.
Series with the same characters.
That was my, I think probably hands down favorite thing in my childhood was my dad's stories. He used to tell these elaborate, ongoing, multi-character incredibly exciting, wonderful stories that always involved like me and my brothers and my friends, so they're really relatable. There were different series that would happen. It started off really simple with this one called Sue the Rock, and it evolved into the fairy stories, which were my favorite, which was these like magical fairy stories where we would pick up a rock in our backyard and descend down a tunnel. And as you descended down, your body would start to shrink. And by the time you were at the end of the staircase, you were a fairy. And so all of my friends would go. It was like so good. All of my friends would go and become, we got to be fairies. And we had this friend, the little chocolate bunny. And the chocolate bunny was always melting. So we had to save the chocolate bunny. Oh, they're hilarious. They're so good. I didn't remember that
part. Yeah, it was always melting. Right?
It was so good. So it was always an adventure. So yeah, it's been really fun to start to tell little True some stories. And
but what's the special technique for the bedtime stories?
Is you have to make it bring in people that are exciting to them and like the thing. So True loves baseball. So all stories, his little eyes light up as soon as like some of the stories somehow involve takes a turn and you're playing baseball or he and his friend are playing baseball.
Well, wait, but the use of a particular implement to highlight things in the room.
Oh, yeah. So a lot of times the stories involved a light show. And the light show was very creative with found objects. And one of the best light show objects, little tip to all the parents out there, is if you get a flashlight and a colander, and you turn off all the lights, and you put the flashlight under the colander, creates quite a
disco
line. In a little rotating. Yeah. I'm actually, can we have one of those tonight?
We have to do a light show tonight.
Yeah,
for
we need a light show.
But I would locate, I would try to, okay, the story tonight. But I have to find things in the room that I would then highlight in the story. So spotlight a doll that might be on the shelf that's got to come to life, or what looks good with light through it. You know, there's a piece of fabric. You know, do a special light thing. The colander is a good example. But I would scan the room for something that would be very magical once it was lit as part of the story.
Yeah, great technique. Yeah. And I remember you let us be part of it, too. Like, we get so excited and we were so involved in these stories. Like, my whole visual field was lit up. And, you know, we'd add, like, and Sarah, too, and so-and-so, too. And you were just right there with us. Yeah, and then so-and-so was there, and then, you know, and they would, you would just, like, fold them into the story. It was great.
Yeah, instantly. Yeah. Of course, she was always there.
Yeah.
Always there. Then we kind of, the brothers started putting a more, a manly edge to the thing. So then the bad kids showed up.
Yep, that was a whole series, too.
Big series,
very popular.
The bad kids. Yeah.
They were always
taking over franchises,
yeah,
right?
Particularly yeah. Taco Bell, which was the only fast food we ever had as kids, which was right down the road from us. And the bad kids, God, it's amazing what you can get into at Taco Bell. It involves a lot of beans thrown at windows.
The fire department's got to go. Anyway, the brothers loved the bad kids.
Great.
That sounds like these stories need to be codified at some point and recorded or something.
I know. I'm happy to see, and Twyla, tribute to you too. You guys have done such a great job at documenting so much of my dad's life because it really deserves to be documented.
Yeah.
So it's a beautiful thing.
Well, it's fun doing the podcast with him because every time, once in a while we'll repeat something, but even when he repeats something, it's not repetitious at all.
I usually need to hear it again.
It's from a different angle or...
Yeah,
I mentioned that you have a part one to this particular hack.
Mm-hmm.
And because I haven't told her much about what Twyla and I did in Mexico... and I think that podcast will reveal.
Okay, yeah, I will get the whole thing assembled into one piece and we'll all be. So, what was it like going out to the land today? That must have been an adventure.
Yeah, it's always an adventure. I had a little bit of a hard time today, which is an unusual experience.
It was only at the end, really.
Yeah, it was only at the end. Yeah, no, it's always beautiful to be out on the land with them. And it was wonderful to see my son out there. I think it was just that duality of like wanting to just experience it and then needing to protect him, feeling like I needed to protect him.
You couldn't.
It was kind of like harsher elements, I think, than I'm used to, with the sun and
yeah, today
it was no shade.
Surprisingly, and the one time we went out there, yeah, it was nice, and then after it was like very exhausted. It took a lot of energy.
It takes a lot out of
there.
You.
But that's, I think, part of the
that's
land.
Part of the
just,
experience. Yeah, it's beautiful though, and the water out there, and we saw some of the ruins. What do you call it? Old Town?
The village.
Village
site with the amphitheater, sort of.
Sat in the amphitheater, played a little music.
That was a highlight.
Yeah,
I think,
it
for,
was.
For her husband, Trevor.
That's
also.
When we peaked, and then things kind of went downhill.
There's one thing that you said to me that Bo said that she had the most, how did you say that? The most fun ever, or like too much fun, or how did you say that when she was growing up?
It was a particular thing we did?
Yes,
yeah,
no, just
fun?
The way you said it.
Wow.
It was so much
oh,
fun.
Oh, like dizzy
was,
with fun?
Dizzy
with fun? Yeah. Having so much fun with my dad. Was like dizzy. It was so exciting. More fun, more adventures.
Yeah, I was dizzy with fun.
Yeah.
I love that. Like
one of the things to help with the dizziness, besides...
Well, you said that to me, Bo.
Mm-hmm.
Spinning on the tires and the swings and everything was we go into Disneyland.
Oh.
So I get really strong blanket, and we have these long corridors with shiny polished wooden floors. Okay, kids, get on the blanket. Now there was one in the front had to hang on, the other ones were kind of hanging on this big blanket. Then I would go as fast as I could, pulling them down the hallway, spinning around the chairs, trying to flip them off, and they're all holding on for dear life. The whole,
it's like a toboggan.
It's like a toboggan, and they're flipping over. Now they're under the blanket, going along the
laughing
floor.
So hard the time
and
of
then
my
I'd
life.
Stop and go, okay, first stop at Disneyland, everybody get off. Then we pretend it was some event, and then
so
they have
right.
to get back on to the toboggan ride.
And not to speak about all the documenting that you did, right? I mean, I've seen
I tried to film
videos
a lot
of some
things
of that.
We did.
Yeah. God, that was so fun.
A lot of
Yeah.
That makes
but Dizzy was fun. That's like, I don't think a lot of
kids get that.
Can say that.
But yeah. Dizzy was fun. What was the Ninja Wars thing?
Ninja Wars?
Is that what it was? Or what was the challenge? It made me think of it when you said, "Stop! Here's a stop at Disneyland." But there was like... You used to do this game with the brothers the most, where they would do these challenges.
Oh, the good judge.
The good judge.
Tell us about the good judge.
I want a recapitulation. That was my favorite game.
What are the rules?
Well,
we had
a lot of kids lined up on the sofas in the living room. Right?
There was a lot of kids there.
Everybody from the neighborhood eventually wanted to be in the good judge. And you had to create...
Wow.
Well, I was the judge, I would create a Rube Goldberg sort of obstacle courses, like, okay, the first challenge is number one contender, Bo, you have to go from pillow to pillow, and then on one leg, pick up the little marble at the end and bring it back, So the game got more and more elaborate, involving whipped cream, spray bottles of things,
So the good judge would give assignments?
Assignments, and if you did it right, then you get a point.
Wow.
Yeah. So I had to keep track of
why was he the good judge?
Because everybody always won.
What a great name.
It's
I never
understood
that until now.
It's beyond fair. That was amazing. All right, let's give a round of applause.
Yeah, it was very positive. A lot of support.
Yeah.
We had a funny conversation just recently. I asked, there's this thing that I hear about, like, parenting guidelines. And I realize that I'm cheerleading my son all the time. Like, every little thing he does, it's, like, so exciting. I just want to celebrate it. And I asked my dad, I was like, should I tone that down a little? Is that, is he not going to know how to judge for himself whether or not something is good? And you laughed because we did so much. It was so exciting, all the celebrating all the time.
All
the good
the
judge, the positivity is fine.
Yeah, I always told, even when as they were growing up, and they might have difficulty as adults, I always looked at my kids as perfect, and Bo just said it about True early, that was the overriding blessing of the spiritual content of who I am, is the fact that any child that's going to be channeled through me is going to be perfect. I consider myself perfect. So I have no doubt that everyone who is connected is being guided by a greater force, by God is looking down, and we are responsible for continuing not only the games and the seeing here, but also the positivity and not the negativity.
Yeah. I've always really felt that way. I don't know why I ever spend any time worrying, even though I do, but things really just always tend to work out. Follow the map.
Follow the map. Follow the cards, follow the map. And there's certain tools that I presented to Bo that were magical moments that normally a parent would handle from, I would say, a normal tonal aspect. For example, she came to me and she said, "Dad, my stomach is hurting."
I did?
Yeah. You'll remember when I continued this. Okay. You probably said that a lot. But, you know, she was 16 or something. And she got, and I go, "Okay, lay down on the bed. I can take away the pain from your stomach." Then I realized that she had made love for the first time. So instead of going into a talk about sexuality or anything, what I was responsible for was saying magical energy was present and it had entered you. So we didn't discuss really sex, but that moment together stands out as a perfect, positive moment without having to be in the tonal.
Yeah, I remember that.
Remember that?
Yeah, it wasn't like awkward or anything. But it wasn't my stomach. It's funny because I actually have this sometimes still. I'll get this like shooting pain in my left rib, but it only lasts for a second. And I think now I know it's like an air bubble.
That's
but
screaming.
It scared me before, and so I called my dad because, you know, always he always had an answer, and he always would tell me everything was fine, and then it was, which is really, really helpful. But yeah, I remember that conversation.
That's funny because he always has air bubbles and I always release them.
Yeah, and you release them. And you called it, you were like, "Oh yeah, it's a floating rib," which I don't even know if that's true. Does that exist? Is there a floating rib?
I was always honest with you, even though my honesty may have been completely wrong. I would look and give you what I really saw at the time.
But yeah, you had said you've been activated because of love.
Yeah.
And it's fine, it'll go away. And
that's what I
said.
And
it's a good thing.
You've been activated because of love?
Something like that, yeah.
See?
And it was true.
That's a great thing to remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And Twyla, you know, really one of our apprentices kicked me in the ribs once. Just to see, you know, it's kind of like Houdini, you know, they trick him, you're going around the corner.
And you know, just to see how
the woman wanted to make sure that
you were indestructible.
You can't trick, you know, surprise the shaman, right? She was a capoeira expert. She kicked me in the ribs, right, before I was going to Bali.
Take care of that side.
Still, that broken rib, Twyla has to work on occasionally. Because that's dreaming. Your dreaming is in your ribs, in the side. That's considered dreaming territory.
Is
like, you know.
Well, it's almost like when he has an intention, it shows up in that
God,
spot.
That's exactly what happens to me.
Yeah.
On your left-hand side?
Yeah, exactly.
That's
on the left-hand
exactly.
side.
Literally exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So I always, with my hands, I release him.
Nice.
Yes, but she heals me instantly. Matter of fact, I don't let anybody else massage me. Twyla takes, the jaguar and the fine-tuning, she now takes care of, you know, everything. You know, not the food, but the massage, the seeing of where I should be, energy depletion if I'm working too hard with people, everything. So I've abdicated responsibility for my physical presence to her.
Nice.
Yeah.
You're doing a great job.
Thank you.
And very nice that you can delegate that and have someone you can trust.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a lot of trust.
Yeah, and that happened almost instantly when I opened up a refrigerator at her house. We weren't living together. And there were boxes of Chinese food. I said, oh, that's the first almond. That's great.
Why?
Well, because there's great food in the refrigerator.
Anyways,
good food he wanted to eat.
If anybody's interested to hear more about that part of our relationship, in my book, In Dreams,
mm-hmm.
I think it's the last story in the book. It's called The Mother of Quetzalcoatl. And it tells about a dream that I had probably about 5 or 6 years ago. And it just, that dream will really illustrate that relationship.
Well, tell us a little bit about the...
I would have to read it. I can't tell it more eloquently than I wrote it.
In the book.
So I will reduce the magic of the story.
But basically, you had a magic entity emblem on your shoulder, right?
Huh?
Isn't that the one we have the magical emblem on your shoulder?
Yeah, yeah, Quetzalcoatl mask on my shoulder was here, but it's not the beginning of the dream.
Mm-hmm.
So it's best to actually read it. So
yes, so you get the whole...
Encourage. In Dreams.
In yes. Dreams.
How does it...
And if you don't know how to find it, you get in touch with us and we'll send you on the right track.
So as we project out into the future, as you'll see in the beginning of the program, I'm actually not the same person that you knew in all these stories.
Wait, what?
That's exactly what you talked about in the beginning.
This is the thing that the bone has to grow up with.
Yes.
You know, it may be difficult for other people, but I prepared her slowly. You
mental
know,
so gymnastics.
But once... In order to take care of your body, there becomes a time like an automobile where no matter how many tune-ups you do and changes and heart transplants, you're not going to make it. The only way in sorcery to do that is to take on an entirely new body. So in my case, which we're talking about the thing, when I was at the pyramid in Tula Chico in Mexico, the Tepiltzin Quetzalcoatl had left there to return. That's the whole myth of the return of Quetzalcoatl. And I was laying there in the exact ritual space where he left his impression and his energy, waiting for another Nawal to show up there and lay there so he could return into that new body. Because he's very ancient. That was me. So you'll see from the first part of the story that I walked out of there not knowing anymore how to do any paintings that weren't based on the knowledge of Tepiltzin Quetzalcoatl. So all my paintings that I showed you today are by that guy who painted like that thousands of years ago.
Wow.
And the most amazing thing is I had a vision in my eyelids. I close my eyelids and I see visions of... I was like in between sleep and waking, and that's when you catch that moment. When you just wake up, you have a slight moment where you can close your eyelids and look into them, and you'll see visions, because you're in between sleep and reality. And I got a download of all of his paintings, like this. This fast, those complicated paintings that you saw, this fast I was seeing them one by one by one by one. And then after like, I don't know, a minute or two of this, of just painting after painting, I'm seeing an armored man closing his book and putting it under his arm. All of that in a vision, armored man, and I realized that's Tepiltzin Quetzalcoatl on the other side telling me that everything that you create here of value, of real value, is actually being kept in the Akashic Record on the other side. So there are keepers of the Akashic Record on the other side. There are beings who keep, you know, things of value, art of value, they keep it on the other side, and it's all there. It was amazing.
Which ties it in to what Brett's doing here, is keeping things in the ethers, you know.
Yeah.
This conversation, for example.
And our friend Frank Nora,
who
spreads it even farther and wider.
Warriors of perception.
Mm.
Yes. Is there anything else you want to add about your childhood? I think our walks were significant.
Our walks were very significant.
Sue the Rock, the first story, everything was based in a power spot in Arizona, around the Flagstaff.
Oh, nice.
Painted landscape there, and you found a rock, which then developed the story that a rock can actually have a presence and talk. Sue the Rock, which you brought back with you from the desert to put on your nightstand. And that was the very first story. And you were very young for Sue the Rock, very, very young. Yeah. Walking together. Absolutely. So walking together, which we did today, yes, what really happened out there? Well, the highlight was sitting in the village area. Everybody had a different noise-making device, wind or a little accordion, and we all just went into silent knowledge at that moment and played that connecting pulse. And then Twyla goes, "Wow, the wind just came in down the canyon." As a response.
Right, the wind responded to our music jet. I mean, there was no wind all day long.
And all of a sudden,
you could hear it coming. Yeah.
And then after that, on our walk back, the wind was part of our walk. But before that,
there was nothing. There was no wind. Yeah, so it was really noticeable.
Yeah, it was really special.
Yeah.
Nice.
That's called power. An encounter with power.
No, it sounds like you're having a good time here, and I'm really glad to have met you and that you shared this with us all.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for keeping these stories alive.
Oh, yeah, this is the older brother I never had.
Nice. Wonderful.
The battery on it may have...
We're back to trying to make this children's
microphone. I want to tell everybody that it was a very enjoyable show. Thank you, Bo, Brett, and Twyla, for being here today, and... we will see you again here in heck.